welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor, sound systems, and counterculture. I'm here, I'm Jeremy Gilbert, as you probably know, and I'm here with Tim Lawrence, my friend and colleague. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Jem.
And we are together again after a bit of back and forth between solo efforts. And we're carrying on talking about the history of social dance and the forms it's taking in the really the early 70s, the end of the 60s, through to the mid 70s. So Tim's going to mainly lead us through this history. He did most of the prep for this one. I'll just make brilliant, witty and incisive remarks as we go along.
So, you need to come up with a more, you know, you need to vary your description of your own contribution, I think, Jem.
Yeah.
Extend your vocabulary a bit, maybe.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So last time, Tim took us through this history really up to the end of the 60s. So what is going on then on the New York dance floor that is so historically distinctive at the beginning of the 1970s?
Well, I will throw in that, you know, we've had a couple of, you know, discussions now between ourselves where we're trying to really kind of understand what exactly is going on, let's say, at the rock concert or in the rock club versus what's going on in, you know, maybe the discotheque, and then, you know, and then what starts to go on at the beginning of 1970, in particular at the Loft and the Sanctuary, these two spots that I keep on coming back to. And I think that one thing we've concluded is we want to know a bit more about this. And the other thing we concluded is, yeah, there was lots of dancing going on in rock, but there was some sort of shift did take place in 1970, even if one needs to be a little bit careful about saying what that shift was. So it would be, I think we're both kind of tempted to move sideways on this and just, you know, devote episodes and episodes really to exploring these different formations. It would be fascinating, but we're not going to do that today, and we're not going to do that in this series because we need to keep moving this series along. So we're just going to focus on the idea that at the beginning of 1970, you know, when David Mancuso held his, we now think of as the first Loft party on Valentine's Day, and when the ownership of the Sanctuary changed hands, and these two guys called Seymour and Shelley, who owned these bars in the West Village, took it over and became the first discotheque owners to welcome, in particular, gay men, but also much wider constituencies into the Sanctuary. What happened when these two party spaces took their, you know, their current form at the time? And one thing that happened is that there was a shift in the way that people used and experienced their bodies, to put it in extremely general times, in terms. The way that I usually would put this is there's a real shift to non-partner dancing. Another kind of, you know, thing to bear in mind with that is that it's not as if beforehand there were, you know, all dancing was partnered. We do know that there was, you know, including in, you know, rock culture, including in festivals where rock would be heavily played, clearly there wasn't basically partner dancing going on in these settings. I spoke in the previous episode about the way the twist became, you know, highly symbolic of the basic breakup of couples dancing and the, you know, the energy of rock and roll and the twist that was obviously kind of, you know, surging against the sort of conformist post-war culture, was trying to kind of loosen things up in a society where everything seemed to be very regimented and organized and hierarchical. So these developments were already well underway. But I think one of the things is that, you know, we can at least ask a question about the extent to which these alternative settings where dancing was taking place were conducive to kind of a dance flow. Let's even call it all night uninterrupted dancing. So, you know, this the reasons that things loosened up at the Sanctuary and the Loft were in particular when it came to the Loft, David's pretty, you know, forward thinking decision, an idea that he wanted to bypass New York City cabaret licensing laws so that he could stay open late beyond 4 a.m. And that meant that David wasn't going to be selling alcohol. So there was it was a differently organized party. It was a party where, you know, the people were, you know, were consuming more or less, you know, routinely LSD rather than alcohol. So a completely different kind of energy and kind of, you know, relationship to the kind of experience reigned there. I mean, I think something similar was going on at the Sanctuary. The Sanctuary did continue to sell alcohol, so it would generally close at 4 a.m., but it wasn't that long into the, you know, the Sanctuary's run that it was kind of, it, I think it kind of more or less turned itself into an after-hours venue. People would dance for longer there as well. The other thing to kind of note, which was kind of wasn't so prominent or wasn't so obviously prominent in rock culture, is this kind of arrival of new constituencies onto these specific dance floors, you know, the discotheque dance floor, and then, the, you know, these this private party, which, or this rent party, which was kind of carrying on for much longer than other equivalent rent parties previously, for the most part, and that had a sound system. David's sound system, which was particularly tuned to, you know, a very, you know, high-end stereo performance that would kind of enable people to get particularly kind of immersed in the music. So the constituencies that gathered in particular at these venues that weren't always kind of so obviously prominent within kind of equivalent, let's say, rock settings, were gay men and the wider LGBTQ community. Dancers of color, particularly African American dancers, and women. And all of these groups, one way or another, had begun to understand themselves, again, speaking in very general terms, as being somewhat sort of marginal to rock culture. And at that point, a culture where people were already breaking away from the couple just led most, you know, and in which it was kind of, it was actually illegal, it was still technically illegal for two men to dance with one another, meant that there was just an added momentum for people to dance kind of individually, take to the floor without going there with another partner in order to dance as if you were a couple. There's a lot more basic freedom, in as much as you don't have to kind of particularly coordinate your actions, your movements with a partner. And it kind of allows for more energy. However we want to understand this, if we just sort of stick with Francis Grasso as our kind of historical witness, you know, Francis, when I was interviewing him quite, you know, some 20 years ago now, whenever it was more, 1997, he'd, you know, he basically said, you know, the reopening night of the Sanctuary, he had never seen a crowd party like that before. You know, opening night was a bang, and stuff like that. And it was just, you know, he just said that, you know, it was, what else did he say? The energy level was phenomenal. So, you know, he was thinking back to this period. I mean, beforehand, you know, the Sanctuary, Francis was also DJing at the Sanctuary before Seymour and Shelley took it over. So he was able to make this kind of, you know, almost scientific comparison, if you like. And something shifted with the new crowd in terms of energy, in terms of expressivity. And obviously, we can say that pretty safely that the same was also going on at the Loft. So whether we want to say that this is a break with what's happened with the past, or whether we want to say it's just, you know, it's just more of an evolution with what's happened with the past, we can see that there's a material shift in the way that people are taking to the dance floor and are expressing themselves in movement. So this is, let's have a listen to Earth, Wind and Fire, Power, which is from the Last Days and Time album.
So yeah, Earth, Wind and Fire, that's really extraordinary. Sort of, I mean, it's sort of jazz funk, that record, but it's heavier than that term seems to imply in my mind. And it's a really great early example of that kind of thing. It's got a great cover, that album, as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That business of the breaking with the partner dance, I think is really interesting. To me, I always see it as sort of coming out of James Brown and coming out of the emergence of funk, and it's interesting to reflect that theoretically, just at the same time. You know, when a lot of what's going on with people like Deleuze and Guattari is that they're trying to think about what it means to be a human being with a body and a sexual or more than sexual body in terms which aren't simply constrained by the traditional Freudian and pre-Freudian assumption that what defines us is some polarity between masculinity and femininity, that they want to somehow get beyond all those limitations. And there's some sense in which the non-partner dancing body becomes but either desexualized or it becomes polysexual or it's both at the same time, and it's somehow this process of sort of deconstructing the way in which we experience our bodies sociosexually in a way which partner dancing is always sort of codifying and containing, it seems. So I think that's really interesting. I'm sure lots of people listening will have sort of had that sense that, you know, on the rave dance floor in the 90s and 2000s, there was this sort of tension between whether the rave dance floor is a space where people sort of didn't behave in deliberately got away from highly sexualized forms of dancing, or one where dancing was very, very sexualized and became very, very eroticized. And there's often, is one of the real differences between the cultures of different micro scenes, like what level of eroticization was considered appropriate. And there are definitely contexts like, you know, the European techno scene is a really good example where so de-eroticization was quite deliberately pursued as a way of achieving a certain kind of emancipation. And you can see all of that really trace all of that back to this moment you're describing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll come back to this as well, and all these ideas of kind of how the body experiences pleasure in these settings, this idea of the polymorphous perverse, which Richard Dyer starts to bring into the analysis of the kind of meaning of disco, at which also alludes to Freud's description, the pre-sexual body, if you like. So, yeah, absolutely. So there's all of these things start to go on. I mean, I think they're heightened by a set of technological developments that are also become fine-tuned at the Sanctuary and at the Loft. I mean, the Sanctuary was one of the biggest discotheques of the era, and it had a pretty good sound system. And it was in this very dramatic setting of the church, with these big stained glass windows where, you know, the sun would shine through as it kind of as the nighttime went into kind of the early hours of the morning. So, of course, the Loft was one of the first parties to be taking place in this kind of, you know, quite open yet intimate post-industrial setting. And David was, I think, the first person to effectively revive the Mirable within this setting. And as we know, developed his sound system to, you know, with a remarkable degree of focus so that it would kind of accentuate the sound experience. So all of these things were also coming together to kind of make this a particularly forceful, affective experience that, you know, didn't have, you know, there were certainly precedents, but there weren't any precedents that were quite as developed as this, it seems. I mean, it is one of the reasons I picked out this track called Power, actually. It's because I think that there was something going on that was, I mean, it's a bit of a banal thing to say, maybe, but it was quite powerful. It was a relatively new effective experience. And also the intensity of the record, which I think you did reference, really. It is a really driving and intense kind of space funk track from this period in Earth, Wind and Fire that some people consider to be the band's kind of, you know, most developed and successful sound. Some of the later albums, which I actually love, but they seem to be a little bit more commercially oriented, maybe, a bit easier to kind of digest, whereas this is really feels like a kind of propulsive dance track. So all of these things are going on. But yeah, it was kind of these indoor settings and that are suddenly becoming, you know, very kind of focused on accentuating a dance experience, because it's a new, I guess the other thing to make the, another obvious point to make is this is a, it's an emerge, it becomes an emerging kind of competitive economy on some sort of level. I mean, a lot of the discotheques of the late 1960s were closing down or were having to kind of be renovated and reopened and rebooted to kind of start to attract people to come along. The culture of discotheque culture had more or less died by the late 1960s. You know, whatever was going on in rock and counterculture was seen to be a lot more exciting. So this is, I mean, in short, this is kind of, you know, this is counterculture moving to the dance floor and taking its crowds with them and taking its ethos with them, really.
And the dance floor itself, the composition of the crowd is changing, as you've already indicated. There's this sense that at this time, these different marginalized constituencies, these, again, Deleuze and Guattari would say minorities, in not just in a numerical sense, but in a sort of sense of their position in the social hierarchy, are coming together in this sort of rainbow coalition on the dance floor. And that's a big part of what's going on, isn't it, in this context? This sort of rainbow coalition crowd is emerging, which is pretty distinctive compared to anything prior to this. I mean, prior to this, obviously there was considerable social mixing going on between different groups, especially in cutting-edge urban settings like New York, going back to the 20s in the late 19th century. But this is a sort of new level of these self-consciously minoritarian groups coming together and forming a sort of aesthetic alliance, maybe what Larry Grossberg called once an affective alliance on these dance floors, isn't it?
Absolutely. David would say that these groups started to come together as far as he was concerned. And, you know, he's a historian of these things, but he would say they started to come together on things like, say, the anti-war demonstrations. I mean, I put the question to him once whether the counterculture, at least originally, was really a white culture and what the significance of that was for black participants, including the Loft. And David said, well, yeah, it was, the counterculture was quite white initially, but it did become increasingly mixed. And this was the general thrust of what was going on. So if we look at what unfolded in 1969 in particular, and the latter part of 1969, we could say, well, it's partly the breakdown of counterculture. But we can also say that counterculture kind of got to be redirected in the very early 1970s. And one of the places where it would kind of congregate most successfully was on the dance floor. I mean, so to just bring in a record to kind of capture what we're talking about here is this track, which David would also play. I don't know about Francis. And it's by Lloyd Price, and it's called Bad Conditions. We're living in So this came out in 1972, so it's not exactly this moment that we're looking at here in 1970, but I think we are generally talking about the very early 1970s. And I think it's this, you know, it plays into this, you know, maybe it's a rather simple idea, but it's possibly still a good one nevertheless. And that is that it's hardship can produce, you know, a sort of a drive towards, you know, wanting to seek out pleasure, wanting to seek out forms of expression, forms of solidarity, forms of ecstatic release. I mean, this goes back to the very formation of the blues in the first place, of gospel in the very first place. You know, we suffer in this world, but we want to have a good time or have, you know, spiritual release. And I think so when we also talk about what this Rainbow Coalition crowd was bringing to the dance floor, part of what they were bringing to the dance floor was a kind of, you know, an urgent need for solidarity and an urgent need to find forms of kind of, you know, release. which was another reason why Francis Grasso would, you know, turn to me and say, like, he couldn't believe what he saw when the sanctuary opened and this new crowd congregated there, at least in front of Francis for the first time.
Yeah, I was just thinking, actually, I haven't shown you yet. I just published a new academic paper, a chapter in a book collection that came out last week. It's an edited collection called Crisis and Communitas, and I have a chapter in there called the Aesthetics of Solidarity. And it is partly about this idea that, the thing which makes some of these cultural forms, which we're so fond of and we're so invested in, so powerful and so important, is because they sort of manifest an experience of solidarity in these cultural forms. I think that's a really important way of thinking about it. It's a really useful way of thinking about it. And this, this record is a really great and very explicit expression of this idea of solidarity being born out of the shared oppression, the difficult conditions of people in those situations at that time. It's definitely relevant today as well, this record. I mean, the book proposal I'm trying to get finished at the moment, is for about a book about the idea of solidarity. I think it's an idea it's an idea we sort of take for granted, but it's sort of running through a lot of this thinking. And one reason why those dance floors are so inspiring is because they do exemplify this experience of a sort of cross-cultural solidarity. In a way which is in some ways really radical, but in some ways is just exemplifying a sort of socialist communist ideal you can trace back to the mid-19th century, you know, the idea that ultimately these people who might be apparently divided by gender or ethnicity or sexuality are united by something. And one of the things actually they're united by, although it's not going to be made explicit in a lot of those contexts, I'm just riffing now, but I mean, part of it is a sort of class experience. I mean, these people are very diverse, but not many of the people on these dance floors are rich, are they?
No, they're not. Well, it depends, doesn't it? I think you're right. I think we did look at at the beginning of this series? It was. We spent some time looking at the emergence of a white gay dance scene. And while there was a mixed class composition to that, there was also a tendency for it to be more middle class and for these men to have more disposable income. I mean, they were quite often, you know, educated to the point of getting a university degree, getting a professional job. I mean, by no means, that didn't apply to all of them by any means, but it was a fairly significant number. But I think if you're looking at the black community, it was much more obviously working class. And, you know, one of David's, you know, people often refer to sort of David's dance floor as being diverse, which carries its own implications. I mean, we could think about this a bit more carefully at some point, but perhaps not now, because there are, you know, it's not like David insisted on a diverse dance floor. I mean, David was primarily interested in human beings.
Yes.
And David got quite, I mean, this goes a bit later, but David wasn't that into, you know, aspects of what we might loosely call identity politics. He didn't particularly like the fact that the Garage at one point, you know, relatively soon into its run around 1980, started to open a night that was primarily for black gay men, or let's say for gay men, but it was a black gay men that it ended up attracting. And David's line was, why can't we all dance together? We're all human.
Yeah. Well, he was instinctively a socialist humanist, really.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, that was his intuitive politics.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, when people talk about diversity, you know, there's often about like, oh, there are people who would identify as coming from a sexual minority there, for example. Or, you know, there were people of color there, for example. And David would sort of understand that all of this carried its own importance without doubt. But for David, the most important aspect of diversity that he was interested in was economic diversity, or at least ensuring that kind of this party was always going to be accessible to people who didn't have any money. And indeed, it only cost $2 to get into the loft on Broadway for the first four years, pretty much. And you would get in, and, you know, amongst other things, you would get, you know, you could eat for that money as well. So it was, you know, I don't think David was really particularly making money at these parties, and that wasn't really his objective. So you're right about this kind of, you know, the economic imperative there.
Love is. love is the message.
So how were DJs themselves then responding to this situation, to this in this situation of a new kind of dance floor intensity and a new kind of community, collectivity and diversity on the dance floor?
Yeah, well, you know, they were they responded, you know, enthusiastically. I mean, one thing that, you know, on just a sheer technical level, one thing that Francis did as a response was he started a beat match or beat mix, or at least kind of create a flow between the records so that the music was uninterrupted. And the overlaps between the records would be aligned as closely as he was technically able at that particular time. So we now credit Francis as being the first DJ to beat mix. I mean, I'm sure if there were any surviving tapes, and I don't believe there are, whatever we would listen to would be pretty rudimentary in terms of beat mixing, but I don't think that really mattered. What mattered is it was the sheer energy of the dance floor that persuaded, you know, Francis to do this in the first place. He said, you know, he told me that, you know, he was used to, you know, doing the kind of classic trick, if you like, of, you know, building up the crowd and then occasionally intermittently playing a slower record in order to get people to go to the bar. And he said he sort of stopped doing that out of a sense of fear, if anything else, because, you know, he felt that the dancing crowd would kind of boo him out of the DJ booth. So we're really good. I think the thing that we can identify here is that there's a real sense of the crowd developing itself as a voice, as something that's quite powerful and that can kind of influence the course of the night. I mean, there's so many layers to this. It's hard to sort of say them all at once. And I'm sure there are things that we should be talking about in this episode that we probably won't get to, but they will come up at some point. But this is part of the whole idea, really, is that, you know, DJs were used to effectively approaching the DJ booth as if they were sort of puppeteers, you know, manipulating the crowd. And because the crowd now emerged, you know, partly through its shift towards individual dancing, the crowd emerges as this really powerful force. I mean, that was what also, I don't think we have quite made this point yet, maybe we have, but the crowd sort of understood itself, I don't want to say for the first time, but maybe for one of the first times within dance floor culture, or at least in the most powerful way that it had ever experienced this, it experienced itself as a collectivity, as a crowd. You know, this wasn't straightforwardly experienced when people were dancing within couples, because, you know, generally speaking, that experience leads people to focus, you know, first and foremost on the person they're dancing with, and that's their experience of the evening, to kind of, you know, and that's how it was. Whereas the crowd, once that broke up, it's a mechanical thing, really, or it's a pragmatic thing, really. If you're dancing with your partner, then you focus on the partner. But if you break away from that and you're dancing as a kind of effectively as an individual, then you can turn your attention in all these other directions. There's this emergence, not of growing individualism and isolation, because all of a sudden you're dancing alone rather than with someone. But instead, it was like a freeing up, so that people could, you know, could actually experience themselves as being part of this crowd, and then that crowd in turn understood itself to be an entity. So we enter into this thing which is actually, of course, age old within music culture, and is particularly prominent in the history of African American, and indeed African, and indeed many aspects of kind of Latin music culture. And that is this idea of antiphony, or call and response, in which there's a conversation going on, you know, often as it is understood within sort of musical recording and performance, as a conversation that's happening between the musicians. But within the church, as a conversation that's happening between, say, the preacher and the congregation. And here the shift goes to the DJ and the crowd, and they enter into a conversation. And on some sort of level, there's a new equivalence here. The hierarchy between the performer and the participant, or let's say, you know, the leader and the follower, begins to break down, because they both have a voice and they're entering into something which is a very loosely equal conversation, even if there's no straightforward way to kind of to measure this. DJs either kind of follow the crowd, or they lead the crowd, or they try and find a balance between the two. You know, but it certainly gets to the point where DJs can't simply take the crowd wherever they think the crowd should go, as if they're in charge. They have to kind of also respond to what's going on with the crowd. And it also leads the DJs to start to kind of put a lot more energy into hunting down new music. You know, the crowd starts to be excited by hearing records that they find particularly enjoyable. And they respond to this in ways that, you know, DJs at least hadn't experienced previously. The kind of roar of approval, the emergence of kind of favorites within a certain crowd would kind of inspire DJs to put a lot more effort into kind of hunting down new records. So, all of the records we've been playing in this series pretty much come out of that relationship. Why don't we listen to a bit more music and then maybe hear what you think about all this, Jem? So this is James Brown's Cold Sweat, and it's the version that comes from the Live at the Apollo Volume 2 album, and was, you know, a big favourite again of Francis and of David. When you kiss me.
Yeah, it's such a classic record. It's sort of the definitive James Brown record. It's often cited as being the one that defines that sort of music he's making from that point on, which is really moving away from anything like recognizable song forms, is using the voice as this percussive element of the overall ensemble, is moving towards this music which is really more about timbre and rhythm than about melody or harmony. It's really hugely significant piece of music. And I mean, obviously, in some ways, James Brown is sort of anticipating all these developments that are going to be intensified on the dance floor. But there's always a sense with James Brown, there's this interesting paradox between all this sense that his band is this kind of, you know, deliberately faceless collective assemblage producing this energetic force for the dancing crowd, and that it's his dance style and it's his music which is partly driving people towards this new style of dancing altogether, which isn't about couples dancing, which is about this individual stroke collective energy on the dance floor. And yet there's always this sense that in these public performances, he's sort of the focal point in a way. And somehow what's going on with DJing as a musical practice is, it's, you can see it's a sort of way out of that paradox, that the DJ becomes this figure who can't quite ever be focused upon like they're the sole author of the event, in the way that James Brown remains this, you know, sort of rock star like figure. Although, of course, in the 90s and 2000s, people will very much try to turn DJs into that.
Yeah, you're right. I think you're right. I mean, he's obviously so charismatic. And then at the same time, he's, you know, there's something that is about the machine within his music, obviously, as you've said, it's this disciplinary kind of, you know, group that is incredibly well practiced and drilled, as if it almost is kind of, you know, mechanical. And he does, you know, there is this point where out of his sound, you know, you obviously have the JBs, you have all these other artists, Marvel Whitney, you know, we listen to Lloyd Price, Bad Conditions, and it's heavily influenced by James Brown, this kind of driving, you know, soul funk sound that has got this kind of raw power. Is something that he kind of pretty much defines. And it's very persuasive in this moment. I mean, it's almost as if half of the tracks that you could kind of play that come out of the loft in this period, or, you know, are played at the Sanctuary, seem to bear some of James Brown's influence. And David did say that, you know, James Brown was definitely the most popular male vocalist at the loft as well.
There's always so much to say about James Brown. We've talked about it before. I have failed to get organized an interview. I want to get organized at some point with a couple of the people who've written the key scholarly books about James Brown. So let's not dwell on James Brown anymore. It'd be good to think a bit more about, well, what the actual material, physical, corporeality of what people are doing on dance floors. Like, what is the actual style of dancing that people are engaging in? Particularly in places like the Loft and the Sanctuary, because I think people probably have an imagined idea of what funk dancing looks like. And if they don't, you could just look up a James Brown concert on YouTube from the late 60s or something, at the end of the 60s. But what's specifically happening on these new innovative dance floors from in around 1970? Like, how are people moving their bodies, and how is it different from how people have previously moved their bodies on dance floors?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I'm not sure I've got a particularly good answer, really. I mean, you know, what we don't have is the emergence of a whole new set of steps that get to be codified and that we can straightforwardly describe and feel satisfied that we've kind of reached a good conclusion at the end of it all. It's much more open-ended, and it's people really bringing in their own, you know, experience of, you know, social dancing and their own experience of their bodies. And, you know, I suppose, of course, what they might see on TV or in the cinema, and bringing it into this setting. But certainly there's an element in which we can certainly say that dancing becomes more improvised. It becomes looser. But I don't think it's as loose as maybe some of the footage that, you know, we might see some of the rock concerts of the late 1960s, where there's, you know, a sense of something not necessarily being driven by kind of, you know, regulated rhythm, but is more kind of a sort of wild, expressive set of gestures, possibly.
Yes.
You know, freak out gestures, yeah. Hippie-ish kind of gestures, if you like. Here, there's something which is improvised, but it's groove-oriented. There are definitely elements of you know, jazz in terms of, you know, use of the feet. And there's definitely a kind of a drawing on, you know, black dance culture in the use of the hips. There's a new emphasis on grace. At least this is what some of the participants told me. And the other thing, which I don't think I've quite mentioned yet, but sort of wanted to mention earlier, and it does come back here, is there's a new emphasis on stamina. I mean, it's no longer the case that people would take to the floor maybe for 20 minutes or maybe for half an hour and then would expect to have a break. People started to dance for hours and hours nonstop, no doubt encouraged by taking whatever drug they might like have taken. But LSD was unquestionably the most popular drug in these settings at that particular moment. So we do begin to get, we do edge, you know, very clearly towards this idea of the marathon dance kind of experience, which, like all marathons, kind of produces, you know, additional layers of endorphins and a sense of getting high and getting out of your kind of, you know, everyday consciousness and stresses and concerns and psychology, and entering into something which becomes much more connected to, you know, the people around you and to a sense of a greater collectivity. And yeah, I have to say, no doubt also the universe. So all of these things get to be sort of channeled through the body. And one of the other things that happens within this series of developments is that it's through the skill of the DJ and through the forceful expression of the crowd that we do get these moments of, you know, collective euphoria or collective joy. This term that, you know, Barbara Ehrenreich kind of explores, you know, in this book. I don't know if you have more doubts about it than I do, Jen, but I do really like that book, Dancing in the Streets. This goes back centuries. The idea, it goes back to the beginning of, you know, human organization, when humans realized that they were more likely to survive in a group than alone. And the way that they kind of generally persuaded people to stay within the group was to dance and take whatever herbs or berries or who knows what that were available and take those at the same time and have a good time. And this was one of the main ways that humans formed, you know, social groups that then started to survive and flourish. So this practice goes back to the beginning of time, and it gets, you know, it suffers famously under, you know, in Protestant kind of religion. which define, you know, takes over much of Europe and much of North America. So this long period of, you know, repression of the body clearly starts to break down in the 20th century, and in particular in the 1950s and the 1960s. And it reaches a new form, a new level of breaking down in the 1970s and on these dance floors, where, because the you know, couples dancing has definitively broken up at this point, you know, because the music is becoming increasingly geared up to this kind of dancing, and because DJs are doing such a good job at channeling this music in a way that hadn't been channeled before, you know, all these different sounds that would work on a dance floor being brought together uniquely, effectively, you do have this emergence of these kind of eruptions of collective joy. And this is something that David, you know, did comment on to me in an interview. He was like, he thought it was kind of freaky, basically, that there was some sort of something supernatural was maybe going on, because at every single party, there would be basically a peak, an ecstatic peak. I mean, the musician who best captures this, I mean, many musicians capture this and contribute to it, of course, but the one who has captured it best, you know, maybe in, if nothing else, in words, is, of course, Arthur Russell in this, his track, which recorded under the name Dinosaur L, number 5, Go Bang, which is all about, you know, I want to see all my friends at once go bang. It does kind of just capture that moment of euphoric joy when there's an explosion of energy in the dance floor, and there's no question that at least started to happen, possibly earlier, but if not earlier, then on these, in terms of actual dance floor culture, then on these dance floors of the sanctuary and the loft. So that's another key thing that happens with the experience of the body and this new form of movement.
When do people start lofting? Do we know?
Well, it's a good question, and it does bring us up, it neatly does bring us up to 1975, 76, because that start, I think that goes back really to Prince Street, when the loft was split onto two floors. And in the basement area where David positioned a couple of speakers, and there was also the cloakroom, and there was also the food and the bathrooms, really serious dancers would start to kind of try out their moves in a kind of, it was almost like dance class, basically. There was a lot of kind of mentoring, a lot of coaching, a lot of exploration. It was like being in a dance, it wasn't like being in a dance studio, but there was an element of that. And these styles became very, very expressive at that moment. You know, there were guys who were called, you know, would, you know, people would, one woman would take a flag and she'd spend the whole night sort of dancing using this flag as a prop. Another guy would, you know, take magic tricks and he would do magic tricks as he was dancing. And then there's other people who are kind of incredibly, you know, athletic or gymnastic or, you know, jazz oriented. So this development with the David Space coincided also with the party suddenly going for longer and longer. So whereas at Broadway, 647 Broadway, which was 1970 to 74, they would generally end at 6 a.m. sharp. At Prince Street, they started to go on longer and longer until, at least routinely, they would go on until about 12 noon, but often until, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes even later, though, David would pull back from that. So just the lengthening out of these parties also allows everything to kind of expand, stretch out, to become more expressive.
Yeah, if people want to know what we're talking about, if you look up Lofting Dance New York or something like that on YouTube, you can still find videos of people doing this particular kind of dancing, which is traditionally said to have been typical of the dance floor at the loft. And, well, it is, actually. I mean, I've seen people doing it still at the loft in New York. And it's very graceful. Like, the core basic move is the duck and spin. You kind of crouch down a bit and spin around and kind of spiral up again. It's actually, I mean, it's very easy to do on a slippy enough dance floor, that basic move. But of course, people do it in this very balletic way sometimes. But it's very graceful in sort of movement terms. You know, it's really reminiscent of, like, the soft martial arts. It's reminiscent of Aikido or Tai Chi. And very, very interesting, and also involves some sort of crouching down and kind of doing stuff with your legs, which would go on to be very influential on the basic call breakdancing moves, actually. I always think it's watching people do kind of classical funk dancing or northern soul dancing or break dancing is like watching people do karate or Wing Chun, like a hard martial art, and lofting is like the soft equivalent. It's very very interesting, and it really looks like it has this sort of spiral energy to it, which is interesting partly because that's also that kind of spiral energy, that kind of spinning dance is what became associated with the most hardcore dancers in the Grateful Dead crowd as well by sometime around the same time. The so-called spinners in the Grateful Dead crowd don't have this kind of balletic aspiration, but it's this use of kind of curved movements, kind of round and spiral movements to let people keep seeing everyone around them on the dance floor, rather than being focused on any particular other person or focused on the DJ or the band, and that became understood as the typical dance of the most enthusiastic dancers in the Grateful Dead crowd as well. It's very interesting, very interesting little parallel.
Yeah, that is interesting. No, and that's this parallel I really want us to explore properly at some point in a bit more depth, but not today. Yeah, Sally Sommer was the first researcher, academic, to write about lofting and to identify this as a sort of a unique style, if you like. But I don't think it was, I mean, although the move that you describe was prominent there, my understanding is that lofting was more about a generally jazz, often jazz oriented, often, you know, sometimes balletic, yes, absolutely, usually graceful approach to the dance floor, but it was never a defined set of moves. It was more about an expression of, you know, a very kind of, you know, expressive form of, you know, free form dancing that could incorporate almost anything.
Yes,
but was definitionally very, very expressive.
All right, let's hear a bit of music.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's bring in this track by The Meters called The Hand Clapping Song, which does go back to 1970 and does capture something of this moment.
Clap your hands now, people, clap now. Clap your hands now, people, clap your hands. Clap your hands now, people, clap now. Clap your hands now, people, clap your hands.
So this was obviously a classic New Orleans track. It's pretty well known. I think it became a bit of a hit, actually. And the reason for picking out this one is really just to kind of throw an extra kind of perspective onto what was going on these dance floors in this period. And maybe it's a bit of a trite analogy to draw, but there was a lot of hand clapping. The dancers became increasingly expressive. They would be whistling, they would be screaming, they would be hand clapping. You know, if a sound system broke down, you know, it did so at the loft every now and again. You know, people were basically taking percussion instruments with them already to the party, and they would just carry on with their own kind of, you know, rhythm section, basically clapping and whistling and chanting and, you know, playing percussion instruments, tambourine, bongos. And so the crowd developed this voice, and there's something about that kind of raw collective energy that this song captures really beautifully.
I think that's definitely true. And all of that expresses something of the way in which this whole collective consciousness is emerging out of this, as Deleuze and Guattari would call it, this deterritorialization of the more established modes of dance and modes of being in the body that we've already talked about a little bit. There's a sort of decoding of the way in which people are experiencing the body. And it's interesting to think about it in terms of some of these ideas that you get partly from Freud and then from radical rereadings and counter readings of Freud and other radical psychologists in the 20th century. So one of these ideas, for example, that ends up becoming quite important when Richard Dyer eventually writes his famous essay about disco, which I guess we'll talk about in great detail when we get to 1978, when it gets published. One of these ideas is this Sigmund Freud's idea of the polymorphous perverse. And now, as a lot of people will know, One of Freud's ideas is that what it means to become a functioning human adult in society is to have some sense of your sexuality and your gender identity, and usually to think about those things in terms of how you fit into a binaristic understanding of, you know, male and female, masculine and feminine. It's always important to stress, I mean, Freud himself isn't promoting a sort of conservative or a very conservative attitude to these issues. You know, he famously says he thinks that masculinity and femininity are kind of very uncertain terms, and he's one of the people who really initially promotes the idea that, well, actually, people who experience themselves as men and people who experience themselves as women will have strong components of their psychic lives which could be codified in terms of, you know, the other gender or the other sex. You know, everybody, to put it very, very crudely, the idea that everybody is a bit masculine and a bit feminine, and everybody is a bit straight and a bit gay. And Freud also famously just refused to treat homosexuality as a pathology. There's a famous letter he writes to a woman who wants him to treat her son for his homosexuality, and he says, hey, homosexuality is not, it's not a pathology, it's just another way of being sexual, and that we're all a bit, I mean, you could put it very, very crudely, Freud said we're all a bit messed up sexually, like nobody's really that healthy. But Freud also has this account according to which the way you become a functioning sexed gendered human being is you sort of learn to experience your body in such a way that not all of your body is experienced as tactile and erotic and excitable all of the time. You, in fact, what it means to be a normal sexually functioning adult is only certain parts of your body are really responsive to erotic stimuli, particularly the genitals. And he contrasts this with a baby or a very small child who hasn't really been through these processes of socialization yet. And the very small child, it's a very simple thing. The very small child experiences pleasure all over their body in a way which is, Freud says, is sort of quasi-erotic, but it's not really, it's also non-erotic because it's not really sexual in the way that the tactile experiences of a post-pubescent adult are. So we're really just talking about something very simple. We're talking about the way little kids like to be tickled all over their bodies. That's what we're talking about. And he describes this condition as the condition of polymorphous perversity. The polymorphous perverse. Polymorphous because it can take many shapes. It's sort of formless. And perversity, perverse because, well, let's not get hung up on the way Freud uses the term perverse. But in this sense...
Well, it's about not being used for reproduction.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
It's the fact that your sexual energy is not being channeled into reproductive purposes. Now, Freud himself generally has a pretty pessimistic view of human experience and the human condition, but more radical and more optimistic and more utopian thinkers from Wilhelm Reich through to Deleuze and Guattari, who we've talked about a lot, are a bit more optimistic about the idea that there might be something radical and liberatory and positive about this experience of non-reproductive, non-binaristic, perhaps not even gendered or sexualized experience of the body, of tactile pleasure. And Richard Dyer, in his famous essay In Defense of Disco in 1978, will pick up on this idea partly as a way of understanding what it is that makes disco so special compared to, say, rock or mainstream pop music. And you can certainly see already in the early 70s, you can see the emergence of these dance styles, which in the way they break with traditional forms of dance for eroticism, by which we would just mean even just something like the twist, where you have two people rotating their hips and making eye contact with each other suggestively. In the way they break with that, in the way they facilitate this kind of very, very expressive dancing that we've been describing, they seem to really manifest this liberatory potential of the polymorphous perverse, or of a polymorphous way of experience and polysexual way of experiencing the body in a way which is very, very interesting. It's very, very interesting that you've got Deleuze and Guattari and people like this writing this, you know, for most readers, very abstruse philosophy, like trying to figure out, like, what does it mean to conceptualize the body and selfhood in a way which is not stuck in the binaristic logic which Western culture has conceptualized it in terms of since the ancient Greek, the classical Greek period. And at the same time, at exactly the same historical moment, although in a slightly different location in New York in the early 70s, you've got these very deliberate experiments in creating and facilitating just such an experience of the body. I think it's really fascinating. And this experience of a whole body sensation, I think, is one of the things that both the musical technologies and the dance floor technologies and innovations of the period are really trying to facilitate.
Absolutely. And the use of drugs and
introducing
lighting and the mirror ball. Yeah, but absolutely. And I think that, you know, just to make the most obvious point of all, is that, well, where we want to take this up to is not very clear, you know, or where we want to sort of identify a change as emerging. But, you know, the twist marks the kind of final throws, or at least it seems at the time that the twist marks the final throws of couples dancing. And once that subsides, you know, the next clear era, although something is going on in rock where there's a lot more freeform dancing and individual dancing, as we talked about. But where this goes next is onto the dance floor. And on the dance floor, at least, you know, for the opening years of the culture, there is no couples dancing. And it's just worth reminding ourselves or drawing attention to this idea that in many respects, you know, the last couple of hundred years or so, or maybe further, of social dance was organized around, you know, not only pleasure, and maybe not necessarily pleasure, but also this idea that it's a place where, you know, a man and a woman will meet and will, you know, become a couple, not only on that dance floor, but maybe for the rest of their lives. You know, they will get married. That is one of the key social purposes of social dance. So there is a sense in which there's, you know, the reproduction of the human race, especially within, you know, growing kind of capitalist and industrial nations that need kind of populations in order to drive forward, is a key part of the economy and the fabric of society and its success. So the idea that suddenly people are going to take to the dance floor for pleasure and it's not going to be reproductive is quite interesting. I mean, another thing that's worth just drawing out maybe quite briefly is the early accounts, you know, including Albert Grossman's disco kind of book, which came out, I believe, in 1978, were pretty obsessed with the idea that, you know, there was still, that sex was still really important in these settings, and in particular in the sanctuary, that people were just kind of, you know, going off kind of to the, you know, men were basically going off to the bathrooms to kind of have sex and to fuck and all the rest of it. It just wasn't going on. This is really mythology. I mean, I interviewed numerous people about what was going on in terms of the dance floor, but also in terms of sex at these spots, and over the overwhelming response was to say that no, people just lost interest more or less in the idea that you would meet someone on the dance floor, because the experience in itself was, you know, this will now sound a little bit like a cliche, but it was said many times, it was better than sex. You know, it lasted longer. You had more part, you know, you were just in a completely different sort of zone. I mean, this is not to put down kind of intercourse as an experience. It's not about that. But it's to say that something was coming through that was experienced very powerfully. And that, yes, at the end of the night, people might hang around a bit or might go to a bathhouse or who knows what, because they might fancy a bit of, you know, intercourse that would result in a kind of orgasm to kind of, you know, to wrap things up. But it was not the purpose anymore. This is very clear. And this obviously reinforces what you're saying about the polymorphous perverse. Let's hear a bit of music. Let's hear a track by Tribe called Koke, spelled K-O-K-E, from 1973, which was another track that David was playing at this time.
So this record, Tribe, was this the only record they released under that name?
I don't know.
I think it was. I don't think they did anything else under this name.
I don't think it's an especially well-known track. It's definitely not an especially well-known Loft classic, but it is one that came up a few times when I was doing this this research that I'm doing at the moment. I mean, partly it's about finding a record that David was playing that we haven't already played, or a record that Francis was playing that we haven't already played in these 50 or is however many episodes we've currently racked up. But there's something about this record which is also, I mean, it's kind of largely an instrumental. So there aren't the kind of lyrics that might kind of encourage people to kind of, you know, think of it as a kind of song that is ostensibly about some sort of romance or sex. There's a bit of scatting, but really it's about a kind of, you know, a shimmering disco funk kind of, you know, instrumental as a has a really great bass line and rhythm work out about 2/3 of the way through. It just plays into the idea of just a kind of, you know, an experience is organized around sensation. This is one of the records people would dance to.
Love is the message.
So if we take this idea of the polymorphous perverse, one of the things that's going on in the thought of radical thinkers like Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari in the early 70s is, whereas Freud sort of thinks as the polymorphous perverse is this thing that belongs to the infantile condition that the functioning adult has to sort of put behind them and sort of suppress, Deleuze and Guattari are part of this wave of liberation thinkers who are hoping to find ways of breaking down forms of social order, forms of social codification, forms of social control over both the collective and the individual. And so one of their ideas is that you should be looking for cultural practices which will enable you to, as they would put it, to deterritorialize, meaning to break down established forms of power and meaning and hierarchy. I go into in some detail on the Patrons episode we just put out about Deleuze and Guattari. I explain these terms in a lot more granular, in a much more granular way. But that will do for now as a definition. And certainly what we're talking about here really is we are talking about both music and dance being used for things which are quite different from what they've been used for in the past few centuries up to this point. They've been used, as you were explaining, Tim, as modes of socialization, they've been used as technologies of the body, but technologies of the body whose function is to insert the body into a very narrow set of socially and physically reproductive functions. And what we're talking about now is music and dance being used in a quite different way, almost an opposite way, not to territorialize, not to socialize, not to codify ways of being in the world, but to break them up and thereby to enable something new to emerge, some new form of collectivity, some new form of pleasure, some new form of ecstasy, some new mode of being. But at the same, from that point of view, it's very striking that one of the things that starts to happen from the mid-70s, from 75 onwards, as the idea of disco as a recognisable cultural form starts to get a lot more mainstream traction, one of the things that starts to happen is a sort of recodification, a re-territorialisation, Deleuze and Guattari would say, as people belonging to a wider public outside the underground dance floors of downtown New York start to be told about this thing called disco. And what they often are told is not, well, disco is this space of liberation where people from many different backgrounds come together and they dance in this totally expressive and free way. Instead, what they get told is, disco is the latest dance craze. If you want to learn how to do it, like with every previous dance craze, you have to learn the rules, you have to learn the steps, you have to learn the dance, you have to learn the code. And this really reaches a sort of fever pitch in the wake of the popularity of Saturday Night Fever, which I'm sure we will have plenty to say about in the future. But it really begins, I think, with the popularization of the hustle, or really the revival of the hustle, of the idea that what it means to dance disco is not to dance freestyle, is not to deterritorialize yourself and experience all body eroticism, as Richard Dye would call it. What it is to learn a dance that already exists, and that dance is the hustle.
Well, why don't we hear the record that brought this popularization to the kind of a national and international audience, and that is Van McCoy's The Hustle, released in 1975.
So given everything I just said, I should hate that record, but I actually sort of love it. I think there's something about its playfulness which exceeds the fact that people were also, as well as being encouraged to buy this record, they were being encouraged to buy instruction records and booklets and stuff to tell them how to dance. I don't even know how you do the hustle. Do you know? How do you do the hustle?
Well, yeah, I've seen some of these books and I might have seen a video or two. It's a Mambo-inspired dance. It's a Mambo-inspired couples dance. If you've seen, you know, this is what they do in Saturday Night Fever, if you have seen that film, I'm sure, and that they're dancing the hustle.
And when does the word the hustle, when does the name first emerge, though?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, all I know is that it grew out of the Mambo. And if Van McCoy really, I could look, I just haven't done the research into this. It shouldn't be too difficult to look this, to find this stuff out. But clearly, if Van McCoy is recording a single titled The Hustle in 1975, I think it's pretty safe to say that probably by the latest 1974, this dance is emerging and being popularized. It may be a little bit earlier than that as well. I think it's important to note that this is what's taking place in the suburbs, and it's not necessarily to be critical of the suburbs as such, but it's just to say that this is part of the social condition of the suburbs. There's less mixing going on in the suburbs in terms of, you know, whether that be around race or class or sexuality. So it's a somewhat narrower culture. It's a culture that's kind of tends to be organized around sort of couples and families in particular. So, you know, it makes sense that, you know, if people want to go out in the suburbs and go to kind of the discotheques that are starting to open in the suburbs, it would be quite hard for them to, you know, experience the dance floors as we've been describing, the Sanctuary and the Loft. And they also weren't necessarily the DJs who had that kind of that musical intelligence and knowledge about how to kind of go and research records in the first place and then select them in response to a dancing crowd. And, you know, after that, I mean, this is one of the things I'm sure we've got to draw to a close here, but one of the many things that marks out Saturday Night Fever as a film is the almost entire absence of the DJ as a figure in this setting. And as I've said already, if you're dancing in a couple, and the dance floor is full of couples, there's no way that those couples can straightforwardly, you know, energetically respond to a DJ. It just doesn't work that way. So it's just that I think it's just important to understand it as a different culture. It's not straight. I mean, although I find the social and political aspects of, let's say, the DJ-led dance floor that we've been describing is quite exciting and full of potential. It's not as though all forms of kind of couple dancing are inherently reactionary, although they do tend to be a bit heterosexist. But still, this is part of what you write, you know, appropriately describe as a form of re-territorialization as the more radical elements of what's going on in New York City, and in particular downtown, being somewhat tamed and given a form of cultural expression that will be easier to mass market across the entirety of the United States. And that's entirely what the hustle does. At the same time, as we've been talking and as we've been spending a lot of time this series, there is this very powerful kind of culture has taken firmly root in downtown New York and during 1975 and 76 reaches new intensities of expression at the Gallery, at the Loft, at Flamingo, at 12 West. At these venues where Larry Levan is starting to DJ, the Soho Place in Reed Street. There are these competing versions of what dance floor culture is about at this particular juncture.
Okay, well, I think that's a great place to leave it. That's really a good analysis. All right, well, thanks everyone. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. If you get a chance, give us 5 stars on a podcast app. Give us some money on Patreon, especially if you want to hear all this extra content we're generating. Or just tell a friend about the show. Or just don't do anything and quietly listen to it. We really appreciate you doing that as well. Have a good week. I'll speak to you soon, Tim and everyone.
Yeah, thanks, Jem. Thanks, everyone. Speak to you soon.
Bye-bye.